I want you to picture something for a second. It is late 1951, and the President of the United States just rolled out the red carpet in Washington, D.C. for a foreign leader.
Oh, and they set him up in this luxurious suite at Walter Reed Hospital, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because his health was incredibly fragile at the time.
Yeah, exactly. And the president is spending weeks, literally weeks, trying to hammer out this incredibly delicate diplomatic peace deal with him.
Right.
But, and here's the crazy part, at that exact same moment, across the Atlantic, America's closest ally, Great Britain, is actively sketching out plans to overthrow that very same guy.
It is wild when you really look at the contrast.
It totally is. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are opening up a massive trove of declassified dossiers today. We're talking specifically about the 2017 Foreign Relations of the United States retrospective, plus some surrounding historical scholarship.
Yeah, we are diving deep into the 1951 Iranian oil crisis.
Right, because our mission today is to figure out how a sovereign nation tried to reclaim its own wealth, and maybe more importantly, why the Truman administration chose this agonizing path of diplomacy while London was, you know, actively pushing for a coup.
Yeah, that contrast between Washington and London at that specific moment is just startling. But to understand why Truman and the British government were so completely at odds over Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Milosevic, we really have to look at the mechanics of the crisis itself.
Right, because this didn't just explode out of nowhere overnight.
Oh, not at all. The crisis of 1951 was basically the boiling point of an economic arrangement that had been heavily tilted since 1908 and 1909.
When the oil was first discovered in Iran.
Exactly. Almost immediately after it was found, all that crude fell under the absolute control of a British entity that eventually became the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, or the AIOC.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. Because going through the historical records, the sheer scale of the AIOC's operation is kind of hard to overstate. It is tempting to look at this as just, you know, a standard foreign company extracting resources.
Right, but it was way more than that.
Way more. I think a modern analogy makes the leverage they had much clearer.
Yeah.
So imagine owning this massive, incredibly fertile farm,
yeah,
but a distant corporation owns all the tractors and they own all the distribution rights.
Oh, wow. So you can't actually do anything with your own crops.
Exactly. They take all the profit and the prestige, and you get pennies on the dollar for the crops grown in your own dirt. That was the AIOC's monopoly in Iran. It was basically a massive tech ecosystem lock-in.
That is a great way to put it.
Iran owned the hardware, right? The physical land and the raw crude underneath it. But the British corporation completely owned the operating system and the app store. They own the proprietary refining technology at Abadan.
Which, by the way, was the largest refinery in the world at the time?
Yeah, massive. And they own the pipelines, the tanker fleets, the exclusive global distribution networks. So the oil was useless without the British system to process and sell it.
And, I mean, that structural lock-in was completely deliberate. It was entirely backed by the British state.
Really? Like, at the government level?
Oh, yeah. Right before World War I, Winston Churchill, who was first Lord of the Admiralty back then, he actually spearheaded the British government buying a controlling 51% stake in the AIOC.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was transitioning the Royal Navy from Welsh coal to foreign oil. So from that moment on, the AIOC wasn't just some private business venture anymore. It was a vital organ of the British Empire.
Which explains so much of the tension later on.
Totally. The company generated these staggering profits that literally fueled British global projection. It subsidized their domestic economy, too. Meanwhile, they were returning only this highly contested fractional royalty to the Iranian government.
Which fundamentally shifts the nature of the Iranian grievance, right? The declassified memos from the era show that American diplomats on the ground got this. They understood it wasn't just a squabble over accounting discrepancies.
No, it was a visceral daily reminder of subjugation for the Iranian public.
Exactly. I mean, you have these Iranian citizens looking at sprawling modern British administrative compounds in the Khuzestan province. We were talking manicured lawns, swimming pools, the works.
While the Iranian oil workers are living in adjacent slums without basic sanitation.
Yeah. You have decades of that stark visual contrast just feeding directly into this burgeoning national identity that was heavily centered around anti-colonialism.
And the psychological impact of that disparity, it created an incredibly volatile political environment in Tehran.
I can imagine.
By the late 1940s and early 50s, the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, was a really fractured body.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing, the one unifying force across secular nationalists, religious clerics, and the urban middle class was the demand to renegotiate that AIOC concession.
And the British just totally misread the room, didn't they?
Completely misread it. They offered these minor royalty adjustments that, you know, maybe would have worked back in 1933, but they were entirely inadequate for the post-World War II era.
Right, this whole era of rising nationalism globally.
Exactly. Their total refusal to recognize Iranian sovereignty over the resource basically willed a figure like Mohammad Mossadegh into power.
Yeah, let's talk about Mossadegh. I spent a lot of time reviewing his intelligence profiles in these dossiers, and it is fascinating. He wasn't some radical outsider who seized power by force.
Not at all.
He was this deeply educated, aristocratic, nationalist lawyer, and he formed a massive political coalition called the National Front. His central platform was simple and, honestly, entirely legalistic. He just said, the oil belongs to Iran.
And what's fascinating here is how quickly he rode that wave of popular support. I mean, the Mojlis moved incredibly fast.
Yeah, didn't they nationalize it in just a few months?
Yep. In March of 1951, the Iranian parliament formally voted to nationalize the oil industry. By April, they named Mossadegh prime minister to execute that mandate. And in May, the nationalization law was officially on the books.
Wow.
The legal framing he used is really critical here, especially when you look at how the international community digested it. Mossadegh modeled their nationalization on actions taken by European nations.
Like Britain itself, right?
Exactly. Britain had just recently nationalized its own coal and steel industries under Clement Attlee's labor government. Mossadegh argued that a sovereign nation has an inherent right to nationalize domestic industries for the public good as long as they offer compensation.
Which Iran technically did offer to the AIOC, right?
They did. It was a domestic legal assertion, not an act of military aggression.
Yet London treated it like an absolute existential threat to the crown. But going through the strategic responses, Britain's retaliation was fascinating.
How so?
Well, they didn't send the Royal Marines storming into the Abadan refinery. The era of pure gunboat diplomacy was kind of fading. So instead, they weaponized international commerce. They initiated an economic stranglehold.
Ah, right, the embargo.
Yeah, but we always hear the term embargo and it sounds so abstract. The mechanics of how Britain executed this in 1951 are just astonishing. Like, how exactly do you turn off the economy of a nation of millions of people without firing a single shot?
Well, you leverage the international institutions you already dominate. Britain basically executed a highly sophisticated two-pronged economic strike. The first part was an immediate brain drain.
So they pulled their people out.
Yeah. Britain ordered all AIOC technical staff, so the engineers, the refinery managers, the maritime logisticians, to immediately evacuate Iran.
Oh, wow. Taking the operating system with them, basically.
Precisely. They left the physical pipes, but they removed the human capital required to run complex petrochemical fractionation.
That is brutal.
It was. But the second prong was the true lethal blow. Britain utilized its overwhelming dominance in global shipping and maritime law. They took the AIOC's case to the International Court of Justice.
Okay.
And while that was pending, they issued a stark warning to the entire global shipping industry. The threat was explicit. Any tanker that docks in Iran and purchases oil from the newly formed National Iranian Oil Company is purchasing stolen British property.
And the really crazy part is the mechanism for enforcing that threat. It wasn't just naval blockades, it was insurance.
Yes, the insurance market.
I was looking at the maritime logistics of the time, and London completely controlled the global shipping insurance market through institutions like Lloyd's of London.
That is the invisible lever of power right there. If, say, an independent Italian or Japanese shipping company tried to send a tanker to the Persian Gulf to buy discounted Iranian crude, British firms would immediately void their maritime insurance.
And a supertanker without liability insurance cannot legally dock at any major port in the world.
Exactly. Nor can they navigate international canals. Plus, the Royal Navy still maintained a presence in the region, ready to intercept and impound any independent vessel carrying Iranian oil, which would tie them up in devastating legal battles.
So they built a total blockade entirely out of legal briefs and insurance contracts.
It is brilliant, in a terrifying way.
Truly. And the impact on the ground in Iran was catastrophic. This is the human element that I think gets lost in a lot of geopolitical summaries. The Abadan crisis completely evaporated Iran's primary source of foreign exchange and government revenue.
Overnight.
Yeah, the state could barely pay its civil servants. Infrastructure projects just halted. Imports of basic goods plummeted. The economic hardship rippled through every single level of Iranian society. The pressure on Mossadegh to cave and let the British back in must have been unimaginable.
Oh, the internal political pressure was intense. But yielding was politically impossible for Mossadegh. His entire mandate, the very glue holding his fragile National Front coalition together, was the expulsion of British control.
So if he compromised, he was done for.
Exactly. If he compromised on the core issue of nationalization, he would have been immediately ousted by the Mazlis or just consumed by street protests. He was locked in a staring contest with the British Empire.
Just waiting to see who blinked first.
His strategy was basically to endure the starvation until the world needed Iranian oil badly enough to break the British embargo.
But the world didn't break the embargo. The AIOC simply ramped up production in places like Kuwait and Iraq to cover the shortfall. And that stubborn stalemate, the total collapse of the Iranian economy, that is the catalyst that drags the United States right into the center of the ring.
Yes, here's where it gets really interesting.
Because a collapsed state in the Middle East in 1951 meant one very specific thing to Washington, a massive vulnerability in the newly established Cold War.
That geopolitical reality dictated the Truman administration's entire response. Harry Truman and his Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, viewed the entire globe through the lens of containment.
Right, preventing the spread of Soviet influence at all costs.
Exactly. And look at a map. Iran shares a massive northern border with the Soviet Union. Furthermore, Iran had a highly organized, Moscow-backed communist party known as the Tuda.
So there was a real internal threat, too.
Very real. As the British embargo strangled the Iranian economy, Truman watched the rising poverty and social unrest. He realized that Britain's hardline stance was practically pushing Iran straight into Stalin's lap.
And the declassified records are incredibly revealing on this front. The U.S. State Department fundamentally disagreed with London's diagnosis of the crisis.
They were looking at the same situation and seeing two completely different things.
Totally. Britain saw Mossadegh as this irrational thief who needed to be crushed to protect imperial prestige and foreign investments. But Truman and Acheson, they diagnosed the situation as a badly mismanaged business dispute.
They recognized Iranian nationalism as a legitimate, unstoppable force in the post-war world.
Yeah, Acheson's memos are honestly scathing. He explicitly characterizes the mood in London as belligerent and just completely out of touch with the new geopolitical realities.
The Truman administration recognized that the era of European colonialism was actively fracturing. You had nations across Asia and Africa demanding sovereignty.
So the U.S. couldn't just play the old imperial game anymore.
Right. If the United States aligned itself unequivocally with a British imperial power grab, it risked alienating the entire developing world, pushing non-aligned nations toward the Soviet bloc.
Which was their worst nightmare.
Exactly. Therefore, Truman flatly refused London's repeated suggestions to use military force or covert means to topple Mossadegh. He insisted on treating Iran as a sovereign equal in a commercial dispute.
But I want to push back on Truman's position here for a second because he is balancing on an absolute razor's edge.
How so?
Well, wait. He is refusing to back a coup, but Britain is still America's most vital ally. They had just fought World War II together. The U.S. desperately needed British cooperation for NATO and defending Western Europe against the Soviets. Why wouldn't Truman just back them up to keep the oil flowing and the alliance strong?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Truman couldn't just overtly side with Iran, break the embargo himself, and buy the oil, because that would fracture the Anglo-American alliance entirely.
Yeah.
But he also had American domestic oil interests holding him back.
Oh, right. The precedent it would set.
Yes. U.S. oil giants had recently negotiated a 50-50 profit-sharing agreement with Saudi Arabia. If Truman openly supported Iran's complete unilateral nationalization, it would set a terrifying precedent for American oil assets across the globe, from South America to the Middle East.
So he was stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Completely. He needed a negotiated settlement that recognized Iranian sovereignty, but preserved the sanctity of international contracts.
Hence the intense, almost desperate diplomatic scramble. Truman basically goes all in on mediation. He dispatches Avril Harriman, one of his most trusted and high-profile diplomats, to Tehran to try and broker a compromise.
And when that stalls out, Truman takes that extraordinary step we mentioned earlier.
Right, inviting Prime Minister Mossadegh to the United States. He actually hosts him in Washington. They meet in the Oval Office.
Which is huge.
It really is. Truman is actively treating Mossadegh not as an enemy to be deposed, but as a legitimate head of state with whom he can do business.
And the visual of Mossadegh in Washington engaging directly with Truman and Acheson absolutely infuriated the British government. But it underscores this profound U.S. commitment to diplomacy at the time.
They were really trying to find a middle ground.
Truman's team spent weeks drafting these complex proposals. They were throwing out ideas like maybe a neutral third-party management company could run the Abadan refinery. Or maybe the World Bank could step in as an interim distributor.
Just trying every conceivable permutation to thread the needle between Iranian sovereignty and British commercial demands.
Exactly. But there is an undercurrent to Truman's refusal to use force that goes beyond just a preference for diplomacy. The dossiers explicitly detail the administration's deep fear regarding covert action.
Right, because this is 1951. The CIA is only 4 years old at this point.
Yeah, it was created in 1947 primarily as an intelligence gathering organization. It wasn't built to topple governments.
But the British intelligence services were heavily hinting at the idea of a covert operation to remove Mossadegh.
And Truman's inner circle was deeply opposed to the precedent that would set. They understood that crossing that line, using a clandestine intelligence apparatus to engineer the overthrow of a democratically elected government over a resource dispute, would irrevocably alter the nature of American foreign policy.
It is a Pandora's box.
There really is. They question the morality of it, sure, but more importantly, they fear the chaos of it. If you build a machine designed to secretly topple foreign leaders who threaten corporate interests, you lose the moral high ground of the free world.
And you create a chaotic international environment where sovereignty means absolutely nothing.
Exactly. Truman drew a hard line. The United States would not be in the business of peacetime regime change.
Which makes the conclusion of this specific chapter incredibly sobering. Truman holds that hard line. He risks alienating Britain. He refuses the intelligence community's covert temptations. He tries every diplomatic lever available. And it utterly fails.
Now it just falls apart.
The mediation collapses. Mossadegh remains absolute in his red lines. He views any deal that allows British technicians back into the refineries as a violation of the nationalization law and basically a betrayal of his people.
While the British, who are utterly convinced that Mossadegh is just unreasonable and waiting for his inevitable economic collapse, refuse to accept any loss of control.
So the crisis just settles into this grim paralysis. The Abadan refinery literally rusted in the sun. The Iranian economy continued to suffocate under the embargo. And the American diplomatic corps exhausted all their options, unable to force either side to bend.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? When you look at the totality of these sources, you realize why this specific window of time is so crucial to understand.
It really strips away the inevitability of history, doesn't it?
It does. It shows us how deeply the control of natural resources dictates the fate of nations. But fundamentally, it highlights a profound moment of restraint.
Yeah, a U.S. administration looked at a volatile, resource-rich developing nation, actively recognized its sovereignty, diagnosed its nationalism as legitimate, and refused to erase its leadership just to appease an ally's economic demands.
Truman chose the frustrating, ultimately failed path of negotiation because he believed the alternative, covertly destroying another nation's political system, was a line the American Republic should not cross.
But it is a line that held only as long as he was the one drawing it, and that is the tension hanging over the end of 1951. We have seen that a geopolitical crisis is ultimately managed by the subjective worldview of the individuals in power.
The Truman administration's firm refusal to back a coup established a temporary firewall against covert intervention.
But history is relentlessly chronological. The stalemate in Iran didn't resolve itself, it just waited.
Think about the vulnerability of that precedent. What happens to a deadlocked, bleeding nation? And what happens to that fragile firewall against regime change when the calendar flips to an election year?
When a new president enters the Oval Office with a completely different geopolitical philosophy, and the intelligence agencies realize their leash is suddenly gone, that is something to keep in mind as we wrap up this deep dive.